Open your mind to a new reality, one that includes the perfect balance of mind, body, and spirit. One where you are joyful and free.
Think of an ocean and think of it having lots of waves. And then think of somebody photographing one wave and thinking that the photograph is the ocean. That's a frozen moment of attention. That's what the body is. But all those waves that come on the surface of the ocean up and down, that's what the mind is. But neither those waves up and down, changing all the time, nor the photograph are the reality. The reality is the ocean, which is always there. And it creates this mind form and then expresses itself as this body, etc.
You are more than just a body and a mind. As a wave is to the ocean, you are part of a larger whole. Once you truly realize this, you will be healed on every level. This transformational process begins when you seek to discover your real identity.
The essential you, your real essence, is a field of awareness that interacts with its own self and then becomes both mind and body. In other words, you are basically consciousness, which then conceives, governs, constructs, and actually becomes the mind and the body.
Our awareness creates, controls, and constantly becomes our bodies. It is this faculty of inner awareness that, when cultivated, causes the dramatic change from turbulence to peacefulness, from illness to health. The Nightingale Conan Corporation presents Magical Mind, Magical Body, Mastering the Mind-Body Connection for Perfect Health and Total Well-Being with Dr. Deepak Chopra. Dr. Chopra has been hailed as a pioneer in the medicine of the future. He was born and raised in India, where he studied medicine. In 1971, he came to the United States for advanced training, and soon after built a large endocrinology practice in Boston. He is a fellow of the American College of Physicians and the former chief of staff of the New England Memorial Hospital in Stoneham, Massachusetts. Dr. Chopra combines his knowledge of Western science with his understanding of healing techniques from the Eastern tradition of Ayurvedic medicine. He is also the president of the American Association of Ayurvedic Medicine and the medical director of the Maharishi Ayurveda Health Center for Stress Management and Behavioral Medicine in Lancaster, Massachusetts. Dr. Chopra is widely known as the author of several best-selling books, including Quantum Healing and Perfect Health. In this breakthrough program, he touches on the reality that lies beyond our current ideas of health and well-being. You'll learn what makes the mind-body connection magical, including how to reestablish your connection to the universe by heightening your level of awareness, how to take control over your own well-being by learning to listen to what your body wants and needs. You'll learn how to create balance in the body by enhancing sensory perception. You'll discover how and why you have the opportunity to renew yourself each day, how to retard the aging process and reduce stress. And you'll learn a practical system for improving the quality of your life at a very profound level.
Health is not just the absence of a disease. It's a joyfulness that should be inside us all the time. It's a state of positive well-being, which is not only physical, but emotional, and ultimately even psychological and spiritual. We all need to be healed in the highest sense by making ourselves perfect in mind, body, and spirit. The first step is to realize that this is even possible. The power asleep in all of us doesn't awaken until we call. To become familiar with the miracle of the human body and the human mind is to acquire awesome power. This power is magical because it literally allows us to create new bodies, more perfect, more flexible, more fluid, more dynamic, more creative, and long-lasting than we had ever imagined. To do that, we first have to understand, what is this thing that we call the body? What is this thing that we call the mind? Our traditional ideas of the human body-mind, or the human body and the mind, are based on very obsolete notions. We can call it a materialistic superstition almost. We think of the human body as a frozen sculpture fixed in space and time, as a physical machine that has somehow learned to think. So our approaches traditionally are also in the form of magic bullets. If you can't believe you ate the whole thing, all you have to do is take a couple of Alka-Seltzer. If you can't go to sleep at night, all you have to do is take a sleeping pill. It's supposed to cure your insomnia. If you're feeling anxious, take a tranquilizer. It's supposed to give you tranquility. You have an infection, take an antibiotic. It's supposed to get rid of the source of infection, and so on and so forth. These approaches do work to some extent. They're symptomatic approaches. Sometimes they interfere with the mechanisms of disease, but they're not the origins of disease. And in order to really understand what are the origins of the imbalances that are created in the body that ultimately result in malfunction, aging, what scientists also call entropy, which means running down, in order to understand that, we have to really understand the body as it really is. The body is not a frozen sculpture, it's a river of energy and information. The Greek philosopher Heraclitus said, you cannot step into the same river twice because new water is flowing in. And like that, the real you cannot step into the same flesh and bones twice because in every second of your existence, you're in fact creating a new body. And we can take a number of processes like breathing, eating, digestion, metabolism, most fundamentally thought, which is a fluctuation of energy and information in this body. Just take any one of these and you'll see how dramatically and how rapidly and how effortlessly and how efficiently we renew our bodies in every second of our existence. Take breathing, for example. With each breath that you inhale, you take in 10 to the power of 22 atoms that ultimately end up as your heart cells, your kidney cells, your bone cells, your DNA, your brain cells. With each breath that you exhale, you're breathing out, literally, bits and pieces of your tissues and organs, and you're exchanging them with everybody else on this planet. Right now, for example, in your physical body, you have 1 million atoms that were once in the body of Christ, or Leonardo da Vinci, or Michelangelo, or Genghis Khan, or Mahatma Gandhi. With each breath, you take in the body of the universe into you. With each breath, you exchange your body with the body of the universe. In fact, calculations show, radioactive isotope studies show, that you replace 98% of all the atoms in your body in less than 1 year. You make a new liver every 6 weeks. A new skeleton once every 3 months, a new stomach lining every 5 days, a new skin once a month. Even the brain cells that you think with as physical atoms, they weren't there last year. And the DNA, the genetic material which holds memories of billions of years of evolutionary time, as raw material, it wasn't even there 6 weeks ago. So if you think you are your physical body, you really have a dilemma. Which one are you talking about? The 1990 model is not the same as the 1989 model, or even the model from 3 months ago. There is a deeper reality to the body. And that deeper reality is what we want to see, because from that deeper reality comes both the mind and the body. Both come from that deeper level of existence. So let's try and see the body from that angle. If you asked a physicist, well, tell me what this body is made up of, he would say, it's made up of atoms. You say, well, what are these atoms made up of? He'd say they are particles that are moving at lightning speeds around huge empty spaces. They emerge from something which is just a field of pure potentiality, just a field of pure energy. And from that field, these particles emerge. They are fluctuations of energy and information. They emerge from a void, they rebound, collide, and then disintegrate into the void. So if you could see the body as it really is, through the eyes of a physicist, you'd see a huge empty void with a few scattered dots and spots and some random electrical discharges here and there. And the question is, what is the nature of this void? Is it an emptiness of nothing, or is it a fullness of some non-material energy and information? Physicists are telling us today that, in fact, 99.9999% of our body is mostly empty space. And out of that empty space come these particles. And these particles aren't material objects. They are fluctuations of energy and information. So just like we say in common language, a quantum unit of light is a photon, a quantum unit of gravity is a graviton, a quantum unit of electricity is an electron, a quantum unit of the mind-body connection is a thought. But it's not even just a simple thought. It's a feeling, it's an emotion, it's a desire, it's an instinct, it's a drive, it's a notion, it's a concept, it's an idea. And it's not verbal. It's just that faint impulse that you experience all the time in your awareness that motivates you to drink a glass of water or walk from here to there. Therefore, we can use the word impulse of intelligence. At very primordial, basic levels, a thought is just an impulse of information. And it comes from our own consciousness. As we think, then we are making molecules. And these molecules are being generated not only in our mind or in our brain cells, they're being generated in our whole body. In other words, to think is to practice brain chemistry. And in the last 10 years or so, there's been some fascinating research that shows how literally true this is. When we have a thought or a feeling or an emotion, then in our brains, we make a set of chemicals known as neuropeptides. Neuro because they're found in the brain, peptides because they're protein-like molecules. And this is how brain cells speak to each other, not in the English language with a California accent or an Indian accent, but in the language of these chemical messengers from inner space. And scientists tell us that there are receptors to these chemical messengers on the surface of cells. So a brain cell, when it wants to speak to another brain cell, it manufactures these neuropeptides that then go and latch on to the receptor sites on the other brain cells. Now, what is really fascinating is that there are receptors to these chemical messengers, not only in brain cells, but in other parts of our body. For example, cells of the immune system, which protect us from cancer and infectious disease and degenerative disorders. These cells of the immune system, which scientists call monocytes and T cells and B cells, they have receptors to these chemical messengers, which are the material equivalent of thought. In other words, you can't have an idea or a notion or a thought or a feeling or a desire without your immune cells actually knowing about it. The immune cells are eavesdropping on your internal dialogue. They're literally listening to the conversation that you're having with yourself in every second of your existence. When you're dreaming, when you're thinking, when you're articulating, when you're just having the vaguest impulse of intelligence in your awareness, the immune cells are listening. Now, if that wasn't startling enough, what is even more startling is that the immune cells can make the same chemicals that the brain makes when it thinks. Now, if that's true, then the immune cells are thinking cells. They're conscious little beings. They have their own ideas, their own notions, their own intellect, their own emotions. Now, this might sound very esoteric to you, but it's a scientific fact. Go to a good neurobiologist and tell him to tell the difference between the immune system and the nervous system, and he'll say the immune system is just a circulating nervous system. So we have a thinking immune system. That's really remarkable. It is a thinking system. It knows how to discriminate between a friendly bacterium or an unfriendly bacterium, between a carcinogen and a harmless chemical, and it's moving around in the body. It may not be verbally as elite as your brain cell in that it doesn't think in English, but nevertheless, it's thinking. Now, What is even more startling is that when scientists start looking elsewhere in the body, they find that there are receptors to these chemicals that are the equivalent of thought in other parts, in stomach, in intestine, in colon, in kidney, and so on. Not only are there receptors to these chemicals, but the stomach cells, colon cells, other cells can make the same chemicals that the brain makes when it thinks. So now when you say, I have a gut feeling about such and such, you're not speaking metaphorically, you're speaking literally, because your gut makes the same chemicals that your brain makes when it thinks. In fact, your gut feeling may be a little more accurate, because the gut cells haven't yet evolved to the stage of self-doubt. What I'm trying to say is that we have a thinking body, and you can't imprison the mind in the brain. That's an old notion, that the mind is confined to the brain. The mind is in every cell of our body. So when you say, I have a sad heart, or I'm bursting with joy, you're speaking literally, because that's what's happening at the chemical level, at the most fundamental level in a cell. I'll give you a couple of examples to show how this is really true. Let's say you have the experience of tranquility, whatever the cause of it. You're feeling tranquil inside, then your body makes Valium, just like the one that Hoffman LaRoche makes, only it doesn't make you feel like a zombie. This is the real material equivalent of tranquility. When you feel anxious, your body makes jittery molecules, and they're not just made from the adrenal gland, they're made everywhere in the body. Each cell of the body is making jittery molecules, adrenaline, noradrenaline, cortisol, etc. Now it turns out that when you feel exhilarated, whatever the reason for the exhilaration, then your body makes very powerful immunomodulators, they're called. They're in fact anti-cancer drugs. They're known as interleukins and interferons. Recently, interleukins were used, for example, in the treatment of cancer. They're very expensive. A full course of interleukin 2 might cost you something like $40,000 for a full treatment. But you go on Magic Mountain, on Disney World, you can make billions of dollars, millions of dollars worth of interleukin 2. But that is, of course, given the fact that that's your idea of fun. If your idea of fun is that magic ride, then you'll make interleukin 2. On the other hand, if you interpret that as not a good experience, then your body will make harmful chemicals. In other words, the interpretations of reality that we make to ourselves are generating from inside us all kinds of drugs. We have a pharmacy here that is absolutely exquisite. It makes everything. It makes tranquilizers, sleeping pills, anti-cancer drugs, immunomodulators, antibiotics, you name it, the body can make it in the right dose at the precise time for the right target organ. No side effects, and all the instructions are contained in the packaging. We are now coming to a very startling conclusion, that the human body is actually a body-mind at the same time. You can't separate the two. The body is the mind at the same time. You can't confine the mind to the brain. And as we go through this tape series, you'll see that you can't even confine the mind to your physical body, because it extends beyond your physical body into the whole universe. We are part of a thinking, conscious universe that is basically a non-local field of information. We can call the universe a non-local field of information and energy with which this local expression, which we call the physical body, is exchanging energy and information. And we're doing that, as I said, in every second of our existence. The only thing is we're doing it unconsciously. So we're doing it unconsciously. We create the same energy patterns, the same force fields that give rise to the same looking body year after year. Imagine you could change the bricks of this building once a year. But if you were stuck with the notion through force of habit, or because you didn't know any better, that this was the only way to do the building. So you'd put the bricks in the same places year after year, you'd get the same kind of body. And you'd have the notion that it's supposed to age. Well, that notion would also translate into those energy patterns. So unconsciously, we're doing this in every second of our existence, creating the same energy patterns. It's estimated, for example, that the average person thinks about 60,000 thoughts a day. Now, that's not surprising. What's a little disconcerting is that 95% of the thoughts you have today are the ones that you had yesterday. So you keep creating the same patterns that give rise to the same physical expression of the body. If you go to a deeper level, witness the whole process, become conscious of it, then you'd realize that, in fact, there are choices here. You could do wonderful things with this body. You could evoke the healing response from within because, in fact, you have the drugs, the appropriate drugs. You could restructure your perception of time, which would completely restructure the physical expression of the body. So it would be possible even to reverse or retard the aging process. We are not the body, nor are we the mind. We are the one who has the mind and the one who has the body. That level of existence is called consciousness, and it's that empty space. 99.999% of our body is mostly empty space. And from that field, literally, and scientists now call that the unified field, because it's the field of the whole universe, from that field emerge thoughts and feelings, emotions, that then become the molecules of the body, the physical body with its senses through which we perceive the universe. In fact, in the universe out there, is a chaos of energy soup. And what we do is we take that chaos of energy soup, we ingest it through our five senses, and then we convert that into a physical reality in our own awareness, in our own consciousness. And we do it unconsciously most of the time, that result in certain interpretations that are part of a cultural indoctrination, I might say. And other scientists have used other terms. They say the hypnosis of social conditioning. So basically, as a result of conditioned responses, we structure a certain perceptual reality that results in a certain mode of expression. If we could go behind that, witness the whole process, then we'd know that, in fact, that's only one way of doing it. There are infinite choices here. When we experience complete silence in our body, then we recognize that, in fact, we are not the thought, but the one who's having the thought. When you say, I have a doubt about such and such, that implies a doubter. That doubter is who you are. That's behind the thought, that silent witness behind the thought. There's been that silent witness when you were a little girl or a little boy. It was there when you were an adolescent. It's there when you're an older person. There's one part of you that doesn't change. If you find that part of you that doesn't change, then you'll be able to cause transformations in that part of you that does change. The physical body changes, feelings and emotions change, the psychological makeup changes. But who's going through that experience? That's you. That we can call consciousness or the unified field. And that, you know, there's an ancient saying from India, from one of the old texts, which says, that part of your body, fire cannot burn, wind cannot dry, water cannot wet, weapons cannot cleave, because it's timeless, it's spaceless, it's beyond all this. To get in touch with that deeper reality is to begin to get the real experience of who you really are. The whole body is a field of information. When you encounter a bacterium, for example, even though you haven't ever encountered that bacterium before, your DNA remembers the first time a human species encountered that bacterium in the whole evolutionary history of mankind, and then makes the precise antibody for that bacterium. That's intelligence. Intelligence is basically information. And in fact, our whole body is that field of intelligence. And it displays some extraordinary qualities that the human intellect doesn't even come close to. One of those is infinite correlation. Let me explain to you what infinite correlation means. It means to be able to do an infinite number of things at the same time and correlate them with each other. a human body, for example, can think thoughts and play a piano and digest food and kill germs and make a new baby and hypothesize a new philosophy all at the same time and correlate these activities with each other. At the same time as it's doing that, it's monitoring the movement of stars, because the body's biological rhythms, what we call circadian rhythms and seasonal rhythms, are in fact an expression of the rhythms of the Earth. As the Earth moves on its own axis, we have the cycles of night and day that cause very distinct changes in your body that you experience as biological rhythms. When those are disrupted, for example, you have the experience of jet lag. Or if you're working a night shift, even though you rest during the day, you don't feel quite right because your biological rhythms are out of tune with the cosmic rhythms. Or as the seasons change, as the Earth moves around the sun, then those cause physical changes also in the body. So you fall in love in spring or get depressed in winter. These are distinct biochemical changes that are occurring as a response of the Earth moving around the sun. Even the tides have an effect on our biological rhythms, because we have an ocean inside us which is identical to the ocean outside us. To just separate us from the rest of the planet is an artifact of sensory experience. It's something that comes from misperception of things as they really are. So you see, the body is displaying this quality of infinite correlation, which means the mind is everywhere, all at the same time, correlating these activities. Now, if I said the mind is omniscient, it would sound sort of mystical, that it knows everything, it's omnipotent, it's omnipresent. I mean, it would sound almost like, you know, I'm talking in mystical terms. But in fact, in scientific terms, that's an accurate statement, because the mind is everywhere, it is powerful, it is correlating all these activities with each other. What could be more dramatic as an example of omniscience, omnipotence, omnipresence? Now, to realize that is to acquire a new definition of mind, not just these simple intellectual ideas that we have. That's only a very superficial expression of the mind. The real expression of the mind is this intelligence that pervades every cell, that correlates all the activities with each other, that is at the same time very powerful, because even below the level of our conscious awareness, it's doing all these activities and correlating them with each other. So it's really a non-local field of information. Non-local meaning you can't confine it here or there or here or there. That was an old idea, that the mind is in the brain. It's not in the brain, it's in every cell of our body. It's part of a larger mind. Now, once we recognize that, then we'll automatically, in fact, even to have the insight is to begin to cause transformations in your body. A person's body is nothing but an expression of all the ideas they have about it. If they have ideas that it's a physical machine, it's supposed to age in such and such way, it gets imbalanced because of environmental changes, and all these ideas, as we saw earlier, translate literally into chemical changes in the body. So the body that we experience normally is all our ideas about it. If those ideas changed, and they would change according to the latest discoveries in science, then just that change in the view of the body, just that change in the conceptual notion of the body, would spontaneously cause transformations in the physical body. In other words, a mutation in consciousness would cause mutations in biology. If there's a fluctuation that changes at deeper levels of energy and information, then it causes spontaneously, without your having to do anything. You don't have to brainwash yourself about this. You just have to have the insight. And the insight itself causes the changes. We tend to believe that our senses are the crucial test of reality. That's our current worldview. But we know that's not true anymore. I mean, my senses tell me the Earth is flat. I don't believe that. My senses tell me that it's stationary, and I know it's hurtling through outer space at thousands of miles an hour and spinning on its own axis at dizzying speeds. My senses tell me that it's solid. Well, that's not true either. The fact is that it's mostly quantum fluctuations in empty space. But that empty space is not a emptiness of nothing, it's a fullness of non-material intelligence. Get in touch with the intelligence, and there you are. You have a completely new reality of the body, and also a completely new experience of the body. You begin to experience it as more fluid, more dynamic, more creative, more changing. You're changing your physical body more effortlessly, more rapidly, more efficiently than you can change your clothes. The goal of this tape series is that we first understand the real nature of the body as it really is. That in itself is very exciting because the intellectual understanding will cause transformations. We don't have to have all these affirmations that my body is this and my body is that. Just the intellectual understanding will cause the transformations because it exists now as a result of all the interpretations we've made of it in the past. The body is a field of ideas. That's what it is. And these are ideas that we've made to ourselves. Literally, it's a field of ideas. So the intellectual understanding, the insight, will spontaneously cause the changes. Several years ago, doctors discovered an effect which subsequently became known as the placebo response. They would give people pills and they'd say these are supposed to kill your pain. And a certain number of patients, approximately 30%, would have relief of their pain. Now what was later discovered was that you could block the placebo response by giving them an injection of something called Narcan, which is a narcotic antagonist. And this led to the conclusion that when we have this so-called placebo response, what we're really doing is making in our bodies chemicals that are more powerful than any heroin you could buy on the street. In simplicity, you didn't use any affirmations, you just had a simple notion, this is going to relieve my pain. And it did so by making these very powerful chemicals. Later on, it was discovered that these so-called placebo responses occur not only in pain syndromes, but in other conditions. So you give somebody a pill and you say, this is going to relieve your heart disease. And they have that simple notion in their awareness as a true idea. Then they make a chemical that has the effect of lowering the blood pressure and improving the blood flow to the heart. Placebo responses occur in cancer sometimes when they result in so-called spontaneous remissions. What is the mechanism? Well, the body makes these anti-cancer drugs as a result of that simple notion that this, what I'm taking, is an anti-cancer drug. Now, just like there are placebo responses, there are the opposite of that, so-called nocebo responses. It's when a patient walks into a doctor's office and the doctor says, Mrs. Smith, I'm sorry to tell you, but you have breast cancer. It has metastasized to all these bones and you have only 6 months to live. Now, if Mrs. Smith happens to be a simple person who believes everything her doctor tells her, then she translates that notion into that outcome. It's the opposite of the placebo response. It's the nocebo response. But basically, what is the placebo response? It's an interpretation one makes to oneself. And what's the nocebo response? Another interpretation that one makes to oneself also. So let's examine that at a deeper level, because these interpretations subsequently become memories. And then these memories trigger transformations spontaneously, even without our knowing it. A very interesting experiment was done once by Dr. Herbert Spector, who is a scientist at the National Institute of Health. And he did a very interesting experiment. He took some mice and he gave them injections of a chemical called poly-IC. This stimulates the immune system. So he gave them injections of this poly-IC and he had them smell camphor at the same time. After a while, all they had to do is smell camphor. And they make all these powerful drugs in their body that are anti-cancer drugs. They stimulate the immune system. He took another group of mice and he gave them something called cyclophosphamide, which destroys the immune system. Then he had them smell camphor at the same time. and then they just smell camphor and they destroy the immune system. So you have two groups of mice now, one that smells camphor and stimulates the immune system, one that smells camphor and destroys the immune system. You can load up one set of mice with bacteria or carcinogens, nothing will happen to them. The other mice, they have a faint whiff of bacteria in the air and they get pneumonia. You expose them to carcinogens, they get cancer. What's the crucial difference between these mice that results in either death or life is the memory of the smell of camphor and its interpretation. Now, where is that memory locked? Is it in the brain cells? Obviously not. It's even in the immune cells. In fact, the memories are encoded, are structured in every cell of our body. Our memories are constantly transforming themselves into physical reactions in our body. In other words, the way we interpret our experiences in every moment of our existence results in this printout which the body is. The body is just the printout. The hardware is the nervous system. The software is all these chemical changes that are occurring, the biochemistry of it. The programming is our own thoughts, feelings, emotions, desires, interpretations, ideas, concepts. But then there's a programmer. Who's the programmer? The programmer is the inner self. To get in touch with the programmer gives us then the ability to rewrite the program. I could give you one or two other very interesting experiments that are fascinating because I think they're very important to this intellectual understanding of the mind-body connection or the mind-body as an inseparable unit. In 1980, scientists at Ohio State University were studying the metabolism of cholesterol in rabbits. And they were feeding rabbits diets which were extremely high in cholesterol. And to their amazement, they found that there was one group of rabbits that didn't get the high cholesterol levels despite being given the same diet. And after they looked for all the variables, they found, in fact, that the only difference between these rabbits and the ones that were getting the high cholesterol levels and the hardening of the arteries was that the technician who was feeding these rabbits, instead of just throwing the food at them, he'd take them out of their cages and he'd pet them and cuddle them and kiss them and sing to them and speak to them. And that would result in a change in the peptides and the neuropeptides in their brain cells and elsewhere in their body that they would shunt the cholesterol into a different metabolic pathway so they wouldn't get the high cholesterol and so on. Now, to my mind, this is an extremely important study. After all, heart disease kills more people in our culture than anything else. And the crucial determinants seem to be simple things like touching, petting, kissing, etc., speaking. Now, there are some other fascinating experiments in human beings. There was a study done at the University of Miami where they took a group of premature infants. They call them preemies in medical language. And what they did was they had two groups, one a control group and the other an experimental group. In the experimental group, the investigator would reach out through a hole in the crib and stroke the preemie 3 times a day for about 10 minutes each. Just doing that, of course, the scientists didn't call it stroking. They called it kinesthetic tactile stimulation, which is the Orwellian scientific terminology for stroking. God forbid, call it love. But in any case, those babies that experienced this tactile kinesthetic stimulation or flow of consciousness or love, if you want to call it that, they gained an average of 49% more weight per day given the same formula, the same diet. So there was something non-material which was influencing the level of growth hormone in their body that caused them to gain 49% more weight per day fed on the same formula, leading the investigators to conclude that tactile kinesthetic stimulation is a cost-effective strategy because it saves $3,000 per admission. The babies can be discharged 5 days earlier. And most recently, in Massachusetts, the HEW, a few years ago, they did a study looking once again for risk factors for heart disease. And everybody, when you ask them what are the risk factors for heart disease, they say, well, smoking, hypertension, diabetes, being overweight, etc. Well, the fact is that more than 50% of people who have heart attacks don't have any of the usual standard risk factors. And as a result of this study, it was found that the two most important factors for heart disease, number one, job dissatisfaction, Number two, what is called self-happiness rating, which means go out on the street, ask people two questions. Number one, are you happy? Number two, do you love your job? And if they can honestly say yes to both, they're probably going to be all right. A very astonishing fact is that more people die in our culture on Monday mornings. More people die in our civilization today on Monday mornings at 9 o'clock than any other time of the week. That's an astonishing, stunning accomplishment of which only the human species can take credit. Presumably, no other animal knows the difference between Monday and Tuesday. What is the difference? The difference is an idea, a notion, a thought. What Monday means to us, how we interpret it. And like that, how we interpret time, how we interpret space, how we interpret physical reality, literally determines our experience of physical reality, which includes the experience of the physical body. One of the things that influences how the body functions is our interpretation of our experience of time. Now, this is a very interesting facet of our biology. We tend to think that there is such a thing as time. But ask a physicist, is time a thing or a notion? Is time something that you can put your handle on, or is it just a concept to explain how we experience change in our environment? Sir Thomas Gold, who is a quantum physicist, a very eminent physicist of our time, he says, no experiment has ever been done that proves the existence of time. Time is a concept that we use to explain our experiences of change. In other words, time is an internal dialogue. That's why physicists no longer use the word time. They use the term space-time continuum, because time is a relative phenomenon. It's not an absolute. But how does that apply to us? Let me give you a few examples. The other day I took a flight from Boston to London, and I met this old friend of mine, and I was having such a good time that time flew. Okay, they told us that the flight took 6 hours or 7 hours. But for us, it seemed like we were there, as the expression goes, in a jiffy. We were there in a few minutes. We forgot to sleep, we forgot to eat, we forgot to go to the bathroom. When we got there, we didn't even have jet lag. What happened? Well, as a result of that notion that time flew, our biology was also affected. The cycles of sleep and rest, the cycles of appetite, the cycles of elimination, these are distinct biological functions, and even the experience of jet lag wasn't there as a result of this faint notion that time was flying. Or you come across people, particularly in our society, who say, I'm running out of time. Okay, they have 10 deadlines to meet. So they're constantly trying to beat time, so to speak. They watch the same clock that you and I watch or look at, but for them, it's moving faster as a result of their internal perception of time. You measure such a person's biological responses, you'll find that their heart rate is faster, their growth hormone levels are higher, their insulin levels are higher, their blood sugar fluctuates much more, their blood pressure is higher, they have more arrhythmias per minute to their heart. And when they suddenly drop dead of a heart attack at a certain age, then time has run out. They've converted that internal experience of time running out into that physical experience of time running out. Meet another person and his internal dialogue, his perception, his interpretation is, I have all the time in the world. And you find that his heart rate is slower, his blood pressure is lower, his biological responses are much smoother, and he lives a longer time. Another person may have used the expression, we are all familiar with this expression, the beauty of the mountain was breathtaking, time stood still. Now watch the expression, the beauty of the mountain was breathtaking, time stood still. Because when time stands still, breath comes to a standstill. Breath and time are both the movement of thought. And when thought comes to a standstill, in a moment of unity, a peak experience. This is what Abraham Maslow called peak experiences. This is the whole reason for the existence of art, or why we listen to music, or why we enjoy nature. Because what happens is there are breathtaking moments when the beauty completely overwhelms us and thought comes to a standstill. And when thought comes to a standstill, then the experience of change in the body comes to a standstill. Breath stops and biological function goes to a level of silence from where we emerge. And in fact, the experience of entropy or aging stops in those moments. So all these experiences of time are literally interpretations in consciousness. There's an ancient saying in India, bliss is the effortless suspension of time in the moment of transcendence, in the moment of that unity experience, that peak experience. The Soviet writer Dostoevsky, he had great insight into the nature of the transcendent, this field of silence, the experience of bliss. In one of his passages in the book Possessed, one of his characters says, there are moments, you can reach moments when time suddenly stops and becomes eternal. And the other character asks him, do you hope to reach such a moment? And he says, I do. It's hardly likely in our time, the other character says. He says, no, when a man attains bliss, there will be no more time because there's no need for it. It's just a thought. He says, where will they hide time? He says, nowhere. Time is not a thing. Time is an idea. It will vanish from the mind. So, again, to bring this back to practical terms, how we experience change, if we're always in a hurry, if we're always trying to beat time or compete with time, we are causing those physical changes in our body as well. On the other hand, if our interpretation of time is truer to reality, which is, in fact, that there's only an eternal present, because in the present we experience the past, in the present we anticipate the future. If we can stay with the present, then even the physical changes in the body will not occur that occur with the passage of time. There are many experiments that in fact show, and we'll get into them later when we discuss aging, that the way we interpret time completely influences very distinct biological changes in our body. So what I'd really like to do is to summarize our ideas about the quantum mechanical body. The body is made up of particles. Physicists have fancy names for them. They call them leptons, quarks, mesons, etc. These particles are not material objects. That's just the superstition we must get rid of. These particles are definitely not material. These particles give us the experience of matter through our senses, but they're really fluctuations of energy and information in a void of energy and information. And most of your body, more than 99.9% of it, is empty space. The empty space is not an emptiness of nothing, but a fullness or a reservoir of non-material intelligence, what we can call information, that is ultimately responsible for the material expression of both your body and your mind. Scientists may use terms to describe this essential ground of matter. They call it the unified field. Other scientists call it morphogenetic field. The term morphogenetic simply means, it comes from the Greek roots morpho and genesis, which means to give rise to form and give birth to form and variety, the diversity that the body is. The essential point to grasp here is that your real nature is that you are mostly empty space, which scientists are now discovering to be a field of non-material intelligence or information. This is the essential you, stripped of all the superficial layers of both mind and body. The essential you, which is neither mind nor matter, but the source of both, being non-material is something you can be. That is, in fact, your ultimate ground. In other words, the real you is non-material. Therefore, it's not subject to the laws of matter, which are in the sphere of time, space, and causation. Your essence, your real essence, is a field of awareness. that interacts with its own self and then becomes both mind and body. In other words, you are basically consciousness, which then conceives, governs, constructs, and actually becomes the mind and the body. At first, this may sound very strange and abstract, but as you bear with this notion and understand it, you'll realize the most dramatic discovery, and that is we're not physical machines that have learned how to think. We are thoughts that have learned how to create the physical machine. We are impulses of intelligence that have learned how to create the physical machine. We are quantum events in that field which has learned how to create both the mind and the body. With the understanding of the quantum mechanical body, what we are really doing is we are shifting into a new paradigm, not only of the human body, but of our very interpretation of nature itself. We think of the world out there as independent of us, whereas in fact it may be a construct of our own interpretations. The old paradigm says that there is an objective world out there which is completely independent of a perceiver. The new paradigm says we live in a participatory universe. The objective world is in fact a response of the observer. We create it. The old paradigm says that the material world, which includes human beings, is made up of clumps of matter which are separated from each other in space and time. The new paradigm says that the world is non-material, that it's composed of energy fields which come from one underlying unmanifest field, that space-time are part of this field. The old paradigm says that mind and matter are independent and separate entities. The new paradigm says that mind and matter are essentially the same. The field experienced subjectively is the mind. The field experienced objectively is the world of material objects. The old paradigm says that the mind is trapped in the brain, that intelligence is localized in the nervous system, or at most in the body. The new paradigm says mind is not trapped in the brain or even in the body. It extends far beyond the reaches of the cosmos. It's infinite and unbounded, although it might find expression in localized forms and phenomena. In fact, the whole universe is this field of intelligence. And when this field of intelligence thinks, interprets to itself, then the material world comes out as its expression. The old paradigm says that consciousness is the epiphenomenon of matter, which means we are physical machines that have learned how to think. The new paradigm says that matter is the epiphenomenon of consciousness. We are thoughts, quantum events in that unified field, impulses of intelligence that have learned how to create the physical machine. The old paradigm says that human beings are self-contained, independent entities. The new one says that human beings are not self-contained, but in fact focal points in this field of intelligence. That we are inseparably interconnected with the patterns of intelligence in the whole cosmos. In other words, we are a set of relationships. The old paradigm says that our bodies have well-defined edges. We are separate. Our needs are separate. The new paradigm says there are no well-defined edges to the body. We are not separate. Our needs are totally interdependent. Our bodies are a part of that changing, pulsating pattern. The old paradigm says time exists as an absolute. The new one says that time doesn't exist as an absolute. Only eternity does. Time is a perception of change. It's an experience of change. How we metabolize our experience of time brings about physiological changes in our body. What scientists call entropy and aging are in part expressions of how we metabolize or interpret time. The old paradigm says perception is an automatic phenomenon. The new one says, in fact, we learn how to interpret, and that brings about our perceptual experiences. And so on. So we're moving into a very major shift in the thinking, even of scientists, that see our bodies as an expression of a larger wholeness. Scientists started discovering this with the advent of quantum physics. There's a very well-known author by the name of George Gilder, who's a great interpreter of these notions and ideas, and he says, in the atom of information, this present era of science acquires its definitive symbol. What was once a blank solid is now revealed in part as information. What was once a particle now shines with patterns and probabilities. What was once opaque and concrete is now a transparent tracery of physical laws. And what are these physical laws? These are fluctuations in our own consciousness. It's a beautiful interpretation, and the interpretation that we are seeing evolving over the last 60 years with the advent of quantum physics. There's a great poem by an Indian poet written in the 1920s, Tagore. He won the Nobel Prize. I think it summarizes the whole new paradigm. And he says, "The same stream of life that runs through my veins runs through the world and dances in rhythmic measure. It is the same life that shoots in joy through the dust of the earth into numberless blades of grass and breaks into tumultuous waves of leaves and flowers. It is the same life that is rocked in the ocean cradle of birth and death, in ebb and in flow." And he says, "My limbs are made glorious by the touch of this world of life, and my pride is from the life throb of ages dancing in my blood this moment." To have that experience of the life throb of ages dancing in your blood this moment is the experience of ecstasy, the experience of joy, the experience of connectedness. That's the healing experience. The ancient wisdom is finding in science some very modern insights. The combination of this modern insight and ancient wisdom is really going to lead us into the knowledge of how to evoke that healing response from within.